Good. I'm glad some of you came back. I'd like to continue practicing with you this afternoon until 4:45 and to investigate the issues I've tried to sketch this morning. Basically, there were three questions. If it is relationship that is transformative, if growth is relational, and if the core quality of Buddhist meditation, namely mindfulness, is a fundamental relational quality, we need to basically ask, how is the relationship now? That's the first question. We need to ask what stops us from relating if we find that there are obstacles to that relationship. And we need to find ways of deepening that relationship. If we have found it is already happening and it is useful, then why not have more of it? Why not have it more deep, more engaged? I think these are the three fundamental questions that come out of my sketches from this morning. If we look at what stops us from relating, I'd like to backtrack a little bit and say something about the way Buddhist psychology or Buddhist teaching looks at mind. You know, without going into too many taxonomic lists and complexities, there's basically three major functions of mind. Yeah, what Buddhist teaching calls citta, the seat of our experience. It's the habitat of your experiential realm. Basically, three main functions. The first function of this mind is to be sensitive. This is a rudimentary sensitivity to things that happen in our senses, our five exterior senses, and things that happen in our sixth sense. Buddhist psychology considers the sixth sense to be the mind sense itself. That means thoughts, images, intuitions, things that come from the inside. Yeah? The mind is, amongst other things, not just, but amongst other things, also a sense function and a sense base in Buddhist psychology. So we have six senses, five outer senses, what I see, hear, taste, touch, a smell, and the sixth sense is what I conceive of, what I can imagine, what I can think of, what I can perceive, so forth. Yeah. So, the first layer of functioning of the human mind is to basically provide sensitivity, to be sure that it picks up things. I think that's very elementary. The lowest lack of sensitivity is basically lack of energy, not available. System is not in action. Yeah? System is closed. Everything is shut down. That's the lowest form. So the most common form of, say, ignorance in Buddhist psychology is lack of availability. Lack of sensitivity is a form of ignorance. If we don't pick up what's happening, if we don't pick up what's there, we have no way of attuning to it, we have no way of responding to it, we have no way of transforming it. We can only understand, transform, and liberate ourselves from something we have actually access to. If we're not sensitive to what's happening, no way that we can do something with it. But the first function of mind at its most rudimentary level is sensitivity. The second function of mind is the production of forms of intention, what Buddhist psychology calls sankharas. The production of sankharas, these are the formative powers that create self, that create world, that organize my life, that organize my relationship, my perception, my volitional responses to the world. So the second layer of mind, if we look at its at the function of mind, is producing such kind of impulses. Yeah. Some of these impulses in plain language would be wish, would be aversion, would be aspiration, would be intention, would be will. Yeah. There are many types of impulses. But anything that wants to move into another direction, into another state, from where it is to somewhere else. Yeah. The philosophical term for this would be volition. Yeah. So the second big function of mind is producing volitional impulses. Yeah. Some of them are particularly helpful, some of them are particularly insalubrious. We don't need to go into the details here, but basically the production of such impulses is the second major job of the mind. And the third major job is very easy. It's to understand. It's the intrinsic, what's the word in this in English? Perspicacity? Is there such a thing? Mm-hmm. Yeah? This is an intrinsic capacity of mind to understand what's happening. Now, you may forget these three things, but the big point I'm trying to make is the more preoccupied mind is with negotiating sense input, that would be layer one, the more preoccupied it is responding to sense input with volitional responses, producing intentions, aversions, likes and dislikes, so forth, the more preoccupied it is with the second layer, the less capable it is of understanding. Yeah. The first two activities of mind go at the expense of the third kind of capacity. Yeah. That's all we need to know for right now. We could go into more depth on this, a lot more depth than you probably like, and maybe one day we'll do that, but right now we're stopping at this. Just to understand, if we want to heighten the capacity of mind to understand things, and remember, the only thing that makes us free is understanding. The only thing that takes the heart out of its constrictions is that the heart understands its own mechanisms. It doesn't let go because we tell it to do. It doesn't let go because it's reasonable. It doesn't let go because we browbeat it into it. It doesn't let go because we prohibit it. We morally blame it for it. Letting go does not take place because of any of these things. Not because of goodwill, not because of orders, not because of stipends, not because of government prohibitions. Letting go takes place for one and one reason only, and that is we understand. We understand that the pursuit, the course of action we take and we have the sole responsibility for, that this course of action is not successful. And once we have understood that it is not working what we're trying to do, and we are the ones who are trying to do it, and thus the only ones who can change, only then letting go takes place. So this is a basic premise on which our little exercise here is based. So one way to heighten the capacity of mind for the understanding of what takes place in our experience is obviously stillness, learning to make the mind still. Well, there are a variety of techniques how one can do that. The simplest and the most powerful technique is called letting go. Yeah. The name of it is very easy. The practice of it is somewhat more, let's say, challenging. But if you want the mind to become still, you don't need a lot more willpower. You don't need endless retreats. You don't need get rid of your kids and your husband and move into a cave. You need to learn the skill of letting go. So that's the most direct and the most effective way of making the mind still, is heightening our capacity to let go things. But letting go can only be done by things we actually have understood. We know we have picked up. We know we hold. It's very difficult to let go of things when we don't know what we hold. So that's where this orientation bit from this morning comes in. We need to know what we hold as experience. that we need to become, as un-Buddhist as this may sound, we need to become the owners of our experience. Not owning because you really can keep them, you can't. Yeah? Buddhist or not Buddhist, nobody can keep his or her experiences. But we need to truly own by basically taking ownership or taking responsibility for what we are experiencing. Because that's the point where we can move in, that's the point where we can start to transform. So much for the theory. I'd like to, in the course of the afternoon, look at some of the indications when mindfulness is absent, or how our relationship looks to things, to people, to processes. When I speak of relationship, I'm not speaking of your partner or your mother, or I'm speaking of a relationship that is to your own experience. That's the first type of relationship. Me in relationship with my experience. Now, that's the smallest unit of experience, is two. Me in relationship to my experience. Yeah. And then I'm speaking of relating to actual living people as manifest forms of otherness in the world. Yeah. And then I'm speaking of relating to content of experience. Yeah. Thoughts, sensations, images, emotions, feelings. Yeah. These would be content of experience, and as that, they're not objects, they are processes. Although we say, well, the object of my experience is this, but in fact, that little this is constantly changing. So it's a simplification if we speak of objects. What we really mean is I relate to something that is moving, that is changing, and that is happening, and that I have some empirical access to. It's not just an idea in my head. It is something that has a tonal quality. It means it is liked or not liked or neutral. It has a somatic quality. It means I can feel it somewhere in my body. It has a volitional quality or an affective tone. Yeah. It is bright or dark. It is constricted or expanded. It is happy or it is unhappy, and it has a cognitive quality. It means it is an image, it is a thought, it is a concept. All of our things we experience have all of these things. Most of the time we're not aware of that fact. So we think thoughts are just thoughts, but they're not. Every thought has an emotional little baggage. Every thought has a little intentional propellant that fuels it. Every thought, believe it or not, has a somatic anchor somewhere. Often these things are too subtle for us to pick up. Sometimes we do pick them up quite clearly. Good, enough theory. Let's take up a sitting posture and do some practice.